Marker.
$2 for what? One beer and some phony champagne? Here's half a buck. Split it between you.
You're so cheap. You're wholesale.
Don't forget, mister. I asked you nice.
Live from the Gulf Coast, Central, and West Texas, you are listening to Free Drinks Next Week, the number one podcast at this address.
Welcome to Free Drinks Next Week, the number one alcohol podcast at this address. FD&W brings you weekly conversations about something different over bottles of something different. Join us each week to discover new wine, beer, liquor, stories, entertainment, stuff that makes us tick. One part alcohol, two part stories, shaken, stirred, with some movieology. You can find Free Drinks Next Week on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Facebook, and our website to be named later. Give us a thumbs up on Stitcher Radio, like us on Facebook, leave a review on our iTunes page. I personally like to welcome our co-hosts, Mike and Christy. Cassie won't be joining us this evening, but starting off, what has everybody been drinking or have any good stories related to that?
Ladies first.
Okay, this will be great because you can take away the show. I have decided February, with the exception of a few days, will be a non-drinking, and by that I mean not exploring much. So basically, I've had some Pinot Grigio, and that's it. Great Creek okay. Pinot Grigio at the end of the day. Now, go home.
All right,
take it away, Mike. What's up?
Okay. Well, a couple different interesting things happened. So last week I was up at the tech club and we have a friend up there. His name's Shay Conroy and he's the beverage manager up there and he's fantastic, got a great palate. But I mentioned that like, oh yeah, man, I just brought a aged rum back from, Costa Rica. And so he was like, oh, I've actually got an aged rum from Panama. And so he got a bottle just to kind of try it out and see if there's any interest. And of course, aged rum not being a huge product and stuff here in Lubbock, pretty much no takers. But it's a Panama Pacific. It's 23 year aged Exposicion, and it's aged in.
And so we lost you right
okay,
when you
well,
started.
I'm here.
Discussing.
Let me just kind of start. We have a friend up at the Texas Tech Club. His name is Shay Conroy. He's the beverage services manager. So pretty much anytime he tells me to try something, I pretty much always have to, you know, experience it just because he's got a great palate. So I mentioned that I bought this aged rum from Costa Rica when I was down there in 2016. So he brought out a bottle of 23-year aged rum from Panama and everything. It's called Exposicion. By Panama Pacific, and aged 23 years, first initial oak impact in ex-bourbon casks, and then it's moved to Tennessee whiskey barrels after the fact. So it's got a really kind of, I'm going to say kind of rum flavor, like, you know, you get some of the kind of sugar cane, a little bit of the cotton candy-ish, kind of molasses flavors on the front, but it finishes with a real nice bourbon like kind of toasty oakness to it. So you get a little bit of that scorched barrel flavors on the finish. So it's very smooth, very great drinking rum. They don't make a spiced variety. So if you like spiced rum, I don't recommend it, but it's really, really good. I would say this is probably the best rum I've ever had by itself that wasn't mixed with like Coke or Dr. Pepper or something like that. In addition to that, at the Texas Tech Club, there apparently is a new brewery here in Lubbock, Texas. And I did not know this because today I was saying, well, you know, I'm feeling like an amber ale right now or something like that. And so Ashley, one of the great bartenders up there, she says, oh, well, have you had Plains Brewing Company amber ale and everything? And I'm like, Plains Brewing Company, where is that? She's like, oh, it's here in Lubbock somewhere. I'm like, what? There's a new brewery in Lubbock. So I took a picture of the can and I looked up and there's no website for it. So I'm not even sure where it is. But it is a brewery right here in Lubbock, Texas. It's an amber ale, amber style lager. you know, it's got some nice, I'm going to say, copper flavors to it with a little bit of a dark, dried dark berries, but really kind of nice. I'm going to say drinking ale went great with the pasta. Finished up though with, what I always like to do because it is Friday. And so from 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock at the tech club, if you remember on Fridays, it's $1 per martini. Yes, folks, I did say that correctly. It is $1 for a martini. So I'm quite fond of going up there and just saying, I don't know, just make me something. Well, today Ashley was feeling a little bit feisty, and so she made me a martini, a rum-based martini, with some lavender and lime, and she didn't fill it up quite to the top of the martini glass because then she topped it with champagne. And so this was probably the best martini I think I've ever had in my entire life. Honestly, it was fantastic. I went ahead and posted it to Instagram. So if you've got Instagram audience, at San Fran Tech San, SanFranTechSan, posted the picture of it. It's got a nice pinkish hue. Definitely looks like a girly drink, drinks like a girly drink. But it was a great martini. So, kudos to the Texas Tech Club here in Lubbock, Texas on the east side of Jones Stadium, for making up stuff anytime I ask for it. And that's it. That's all I've had.
That's it. Wow. No, that's amazing, actually. I don't think I remember them having the $1 martini. That's the most Lubbock thing that probably Club Corps does, is way affordable drinking. And, damn, I miss that place. I still keep my membership, but now since everybody's leaving Lubbock, it might finally be time to cancel it. Play the funeral music.
it makes me sad? I was a member when I was there, but you guys weren't members. And then I left and never became members.
and we probably became members from the experiences of going up there with you when you were a member. So, consequently, you've probably helped at least grow their membership by 20, just in the group of people I know. That doesn't include everyone that Mike has influenced to join there. So it's like three or four degrees of separation. You're probably a quarter of the club.
All I can say is, like, about 2.5 years ago, I was the only ambassador that was a member of the tech club, and it was like, I think it was right after Chris left. And I started talking about it, and of course they actually got an ambassador to, like, or somebody who works there to join the ambassador group. And so now there's like 40 or 50 ambassadors, and it's kind of the only place in town that I go now, and I like see people like, oh, hey, how are you doing? No, not working, just packing. Yeah, moving from Lubbock to Houston. Oh yeah, I've got family down there. Oh, that's where I graduated high school from. Yes, I know they're all liberal. Sorry, that's the typical conversation these days.
Well,
I'm trying to think of what I drank last week. It wasn't anything too interesting. It was probably the most beer that I've drank since two football seasons ago. But I survived it and I'm still alive, even though I almost screwed up my diet. I am down 10 pounds in 1 month, so I'm trying to get down another 70 to get back where I should be. But this
wow.
week... Okay, wait, what?
For you.
Oh, okay.
I said, yeah. Wow. Wow, good for you.
Yeah, that's the goal.
Yeah,
we'll
awesome,
see.
Man.
And so kid snacks are the death of me. Like, I eat so many goldfish just because they're there. Wow, goldfish are delicious. And so are Teddy Grahams. And I'm trying to think of just all the things Christopher eats, but I probably eat more of. But despite that point, tonight I'm actually drinking a local beer, I guess generally local for the Houston area, out of Porter, Texas, Back Pew Brewing, like a pew at a church. Their saying is, drink like a saint, drink like a saint. So this is their Blue Testament American Pilsner. It's pretty light. It does taste better than, I guess, the adjunct lagers. It's not as heavy as a traditional Budweiser or Miller Genuine Draft, but it's pretty smooth all the way out. I'm going to probably have to go visit it because the beer is good. It kind of reminds me or similar to the smoothness that Under the Radar Brewery has in their downtown in Houston, another small one that grew there. But that's pretty much interesting what I drank this week. I do have a group of people where we're trying to do, after missing the opportunity to go to the Texas Monthly Whiskey Tasting, because it's on a weekday and I can't take another day off, me and some friends down in Houston are going to do our own whiskey tasting, bringing our collection together and sampling through it just to get a general wide variety and experience there. It's going to be at the end of the month, so hopefully other people will be able to join us. I know Mike's in the middle of a move, but we'll probably have it on a Saturday, which I know isn't too convenient for your schedule, Christy, but it should be an interesting range, as that's probably been the collection I've been most focused on for 2 years now, that I'm not in the liquor industry and don't get it for free. I probably have more whiskey than I ever have. And that's what I've been very drinking.
Cool. I have something to add there, though.
Okay.
If Mike is moving, and if he is there at that point, I know he might not be, and that's understandable. It's a big move. I've done it. Not exactly that long, but it's a big move. I have a lovely bottle, even though I can't make it, that I would like to add to your tasting. And I drink a little bit of it on one of the shows, but I'm not really a whiskey bourbon. Are you doing just whiskey, or are you doing bourbon too?
I'm primarily doing bourbon. Or my contribution will truly be bourbon. It'll be all types of whiskey. As I know, one of the other people that's joining us, they're a big fan of Canadian whiskey. And my dad's a big fan of Scotch. So we're going to have a variety there. And hopefully an Uber on call.
I love it. Well, nice. If I can transport this somehow, maybe I even just mail it to you. Although the only issue is with mailing is that it has been opened and I drank like two fingers, is the Garrison Brothers Estacado, Texas straight bourbon whiskey. It's from High, Texas, but this is the one that was aged in the Llano Estacado port barrels, so I think it would be a really nice addition to your tasting, and I'm happy to send the bottle that way if anybody's interested.
And we, as we welcome that, we prefer you to be there with your bottle and contribution. One thing that I don't know, what was that documentary about, like Rudy Kekarian, the one who made up all the fake drinks that were just classics, and he had the palate. And they have one of the stories there where the group that he gets into, it's just a tasting group where they share a bottle every time. And when they accept new people in the group, they have to bring something phenomenal to join there. At some deep point in me, this isn't on paper or documented or planned, I would like to eventually build a tasting group that just goes through different varieties and different styles, but not a massive group, but an insular group that just has the appreciation for the beverages. So wine, whiskey, rum, different styles, different tastes, and build events around it, hopefully. So that's an eventual goal. So this is going to be the first one, and it was inspired by Texas Monthly. And depending on how it goes and when, based on the rest of the show's availability, we could surely schedule the next one with a different type, varietal, or flavor of alcohol.
I love this. I think it's a great idea.
And so, well, I think we could get into a couple of stories since we are discussing pairings and what goes together. It's getting to be that time of year when you don't mind buying stuff on behalf of parents getting money for their kids. And that item is Girl Scout cookies. Delicious Girl Scout cookies. Now, this isn't going to be a story about which Girl Scout cookie is the best, but it is a story developed by Herald Mail Media, Alicia Notarani, in which they developed a wine pairing menu with Girl Scout cookies. And so just a couple of these, and we'll post this on the show notes, is you don't have to pair it with cheese. The article is There's a new kid in town. She's been around since 1917 in her earliest form, but 1930, the Girl Scout cookies became a commercial enterprise. And now that they have passed their 100th anniversary, while wine and cheese are classic companions, the cool new seasonal pairing on the block is Girl Scout cookies. Cindy Rowe, who owns Funkstown Blue Mountain Wine Crafters with her husband Tim Rowe, says they're planning an event. They're going to get some cookies ordered and have a pairing here. With Caramel Delights, also known as Samoas, or her favorite, Rowe said the perfect wine companion would be a Malbec or Cabernet Sauvignon. I just think it would go well together because Malbec has plum and black cherry notes that would go well with the chocolate and caramel. She first heard of the wine pairing with famous cookies on Pinterest and similar websites. Many wine enthusiasts pair with chocolate during the month of February. And I thought Girl Scout cookies would be a good idea for March. So some different pairings based on this are Brunello and Thin Mints, Riesling and shortbread, which are also called trefoils now, apparently. Tagalongs and Amarone. Savannah Smiles and Rosé. And Toffee-tastic with French Bordeaux-style wine. So, just a couple of pairings to look ahead. And maybe this could be a second event that we pull off in March or April if anybody's available.
Yeah, I've long Thin Mints being the most popular one, obviously. Port and Thin Mints is always a good choice. Some of the Caramel Delights, I think, is what they were called. Really, really good with different red wines. But I kind of agree with you. You said something like whatever they're called right now. There's one cookie that changes its name every single year. And, like, I can't even remember what it used to be called. I don't know what it's called now. I just know when I see the box, and I'm like, oh, that's the cookie I want. So.
And so what's the flavor of the cookie that you're referencing?
It's not shortbread, per se, but it's, like, shortbread with, like, some caramel or chocolate, like a sandwich-style cookie or something like that, so.
See, that's what I'm thinking, because I like the shortbreads, but I've never seen this name, but it looks just like shortbread.
It's like a shortbread sandwich, let's put it that way. But, yeah, I know what you're talking about. I think that some days they change the names just because they can. But, like, if they ever change the name of Thin Mints, people would lose their shit. People would riot. There'd be whole cities like Cleveland that are useless, burned down to the ground. Like, so that's the only one they cannot touch. But everything else, they're just like, this year let's call it Sunshine Delight.
I take offense to the Cleveland statement. That is a great drinking town. And just because the river caught on fire is not an indictment on the current Cleveland.
I'm pretty sure if you're a town and your river catches fire, the rest of your town deserves to catch fire too. It's water. It's wet. How does it catch fire? This does not make sense.
A little pollution here, a little spark here, the river catches on fire. You love movies when it happens. Think of Lethal Weapon 4. So now we're holding grudges against cities for fires that occurred 7 years ago. Let's go ahead and talk about Chicago then.
I mean, with all of the chemicals that they dump in the river in Chicago, to, like, dye it green or dye it blue or dye it red, I can believe that catches fire. I mean, but Cleveland, I will give you, does have its own song saying, Cleveland rocks, Cleveland rocks. No other city has that other than, like, New York.
Is that a Cleveland song or Drew, what's his name?
Drew Carey? Drew Carey theme song. Hey,
I think that
it's a theme
counts.
Song. Yeah, I think it counts.
See, and that wasn't even one of the things that I was holding up as a redeeming factor of Cleveland. The fact that the host of The Price is Right is from Cleveland, that gets it like 100 points right there. The fact they have probably one of the best whiskey bars in the nation gets it another 100 points. They have great stadiums in terms of baseball. Their football fans are way too dedicated. Mm-hmm. And they have the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I think that's a lot of... Oh, they have the Football Hall of Fame less than 2 hours away. I think this is way more redeeming factors than plenty of cities and states that you wouldn't even consider to be, or you wouldn't even throw the adjectives you just used to explain Cleveland.
Can I just point something out?
Yes.
We all live in Texas, and Texas is very big, but Chris and Cassie currently, and Mike very soon, yes, pretty much on the Gulf of Mexico, where there's oil spills. Oil equals fire. Like, fires happen. I wish it wasn't a thing, but I feel like we can't really be, as Texans, casting too much shade when we're not really that much better. Oil spills, just saying.
Blasphemous.
The prosecution would like to interject that only one state has ever been its own country, and that's the state of Laughlin in Lubbock, Texas. That's it.
Look, I'm a very proud, I'm a born and raised Texan. I had a customer today that was like, I want a Cabernet. I gave her a Cabernet Syrah. And she was like, oh, I don't love this. That's a good wine. And she didn't want to do a tasting. She decided on Mosaic, which I love. It's our big Bordeaux-style blend, Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, and Merlot. It's fantastic. It's my favorite of Great Creek wines. And so she bought a glass. And she's like, oh, this is great. And then she was like, is this a Texas winery? You just came into a winery on the square in Georgetown, Texas. Yes, it's a Texas winery. I didn't say it like that, but that's what I was thinking. And she was like, oh, yeah, these taste like Texas wines. Oh, where are you from? Fort Worth. Are you kidding me right now, lady?
The sad part, Brian Hamilton posted a picture of kind of like the state of Texas and what the opinion generally is of cities with of citizens from different cities in Texas from other citizens. So they're like Lubbock full of drinking and dirt. And they're like Houston, big people, the Gulf of Mexico, the north half of Gulf of Mexico, disgusting, the southern part of Texas where decent beaches, and then Dallas is just like the rich, pompous jerks. And so I just find it funny that you're pointing out these aspects of this map that he posted. And I was trying to be like, that's not, oh, that might be true.
Maybe. I lived there before. When I moved to Lubbock, I had a hard time getting hired because I was telling everybody I was from Dallas. Took me a year to fully get it. But what I basically was informed of eventually by friends is there's a thing called Dallitude.
Okay, please explain more of Dallitude. I have never heard this term.
Yeah, it took me about a year in Lubbock. Like, it was a little bit of a struggle. But, yeah, people have these impressions, and especially being a big college town, apparently the people from Dallas, like, overly entitled. And even though that's not my personality, I was getting pigeonholed into this group. So I quit telling people where I was from, and then I got a job.
Okay. Well,
I mean, in all fairness, the Mavericks were the last Dallas team to win any title in any of their sports. But you'd think by listening to the Dallas fans that every single day they're going to win a title in one of the sports.
I will say Dallas.
I think that's most people, unless you're a Cubs fan. Then they had that 1 year in 100, so that was good.
I do want to say is that I feel that Dallas fandom and the radio industry that's built around it is what makes it so amusing. Because they start the year off so optimistically, similar to New York Knicks fans. And then by the middle of it...
Or Texas Tech fans.
Texas Tech fans, we were just overly optimistic, which is why we fired a coach and screwed him over, and then he left to become a top 25 coach at a different school. Not holding grudges. But Dallas fans are similar to Knicks fans. By the middle of the season, it's the justification and excuses, and then by the end of the season, it's, well, you don't live in New York, the greatest city, or you don't have four titles like the Dallas Cowboys do. And that's always how it ends at the end of the season. I just feel like it's one of those things. It's almost abusive, the relationship that Dallas sports has with their fans.
I can agree. It's almost one of those, I can't think of the phrase right now, but it's one of those, like women who is constantly being promised the world by her man, and yet he's a junkie musician and everything who's literally just taking money out of her bank account to keep his dreams alive.
Isn't that
actually that's a really good analogy. So
isn't that Lester Diamond from Casino?
Wait, Casino?
Casino.
Yeah. Not the Robert De Niro character. Sorry, the other guy.
No, yeah, the one with Robert De Niro's wife that just kept taking her money.
Woody Harrelson. Woody Harrelson. Yeah.
Think it was Woody Harrelson. It was somebody else.
James Woods. James Woods.
That's who it was. James Wood. Like a super skinny James Wood at that too. Like he went anorexic for that role. But it does remind me, the analogy you use is perfect, but it reminds you specifically of Casino. It's exactly that situation, that they just keep giving their money to it, even though they're going to abuse them and break their heart at the end, every single time.
Yeah, until your casino boss husband breaks his legs and beats him up. That's pretty much it.
Well, Newsweek posted an article. To avoid New Year's drinking ban, group builds tiny private island in New Zealand waters. A group of people celebrating New Year's in New Zealand built their own tiny private structure in coastal waters to avoid an island-wide liquor ban that was in effect during New Year's Eve events. The group of Kiwis built the sand structure during low tide on Sunday off the coast, a town near New Zealand Northern Island, according to the local news, and then waited for the rising tide to surround them. The Sydney Morning Herald tweeted a picture of a man-made island and reported that members of the group joked that they were in international waters and thus free from the alcohol ban that extended to the beaches and outdoor events. The inhabitants of the island and in the range in 2018 with alcohol beverages. It's creative thinking. If I'd known about it, I probably would have joined them. The local commander inspector, the police chief, told the New Zealand Herald. The paper reported that the group was seen with the cooler and a picnic table on the Sand Mound private island. People in kayaks and on stand-up rafts paddled around them. So happy New Year, and a really happy New Year for a group of New Zealanders. What's the most creative drinking concept you've ever experienced or seen?
All right, first, I've just got to comment on that, because I'm pretty sure international waters actually start like 50 miles, 100 miles from the coast or something like that.
I think it's like 90 miles is international waters.
Yeah.
Maybe or 120.
I mean, this is clever. That is pretty awesome and everything. I mean, I've heard about people like drinking in hot air balloons or something in Utah, to where they're not subject to like TABC laws or whatever Utah's alcohol agency is and stuff like that. So that's maybe a little bit more clever and stuff. I still would have partied with them. I'm not saying that, but I'm just like, it's a little farther out. Somebody should have told them that.
Are you saying 90 miles?
Yes, yeah. I thought it was 90 miles.
International waters don't start like right off the coast. It's a ways out there.
Okay, well, let me shoot this to you. If you're in Key West, Florida, you go to the southernmost point, there's literally a sign that says 90 miles to Cuba. So we're international waters between Florida and Cuba.
And you are correct. The definition for it, territorial waters or territorial sea, is defined by the 1982 United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, is a belt of coastal waters extending at most 12 nautical miles from the baseline, usually the low water mark of a coastal state.
Wait, 12 nautical miles, though, is that, I don't think that's normal miles, is it?
That doesn't seem like enough, because we don't we have, like, oil barges further than 12 miles out?
Yeah, but they're not in our waters. They have to be the Coast Guard and the Navy defend them, supposedly.
Okay. Yeah, so I was way off, and you're right. Cuba's not that far, which explains how people could paddle from Cuba to the U.S. All right. Stuff I don't know until I don't know it. But you're right. These people, it doesn't quite count as international waters, but it looks like the police chief has a sense of humor and doesn't care.
This is a crazy thing to me. So this is only for New Year's Eve or New Year's Day?
It looks like only for New Year's Day in New Zealand.
So they're trying to they're trying to contain a little bit, but didn't really work.
Well, maybe it did work, because how much violence could really happen when you're on a 4-foot island with 7 people? Like, most likely it'll go really good, but if one of those 7 is Charles Manson, it could go horribly bad.
Yeah.
I probably went too far on that comparison.
I think it's relevant considering our later topic. Apparently Leonardo DiCaprio is going to play him in a movie. So.
Speaking of that, did anybody read that article with Quincy Jones just about, like, his whole career in the music industry and all the stories that he had? And he had, like, all these random things. Like, for one, he has something crazy. He's like, I have 40 girlfriends, and they know about each other, but that's the thing with keeping me young and how I'm going to live to 120. But another part of the story is he indicated he was supposed to be at that Charles Man at the ranch when those murders took place, going to a party that night when everything occurred. But something held him up to where he couldn't show up and avoided that mass murder that Charles Manson helped precipitate.
Well, the thing about those murders is, I'm pretty sure none of the people who were murdered were the intended targets. It was the director, who was, I'm pretty sure the husband of the, I'm trying to think of the name of the pregnant actress who was there and stuff. She was either the husband or the girlfriend, and everything. They were actually after him, supposedly because of some of the there's a lot of like if you actually read the stories about the murders and stuff, there are of the Manson family. It was Sharon Tate, as I recall.
Yes,
but there was somebody. who introduced them, the family, to her, and the director's name is just, like, completely throwing me right now. But it's introduced her to them and everything like that. Oh, Dennis Wilson. Dennis Deep Sea Wilson of the Beach Boys is the one that initially took them to the house and stuff like that. And then they were after the actual director, Roman Polanski. They were after the director. Sorry, I had to look at the director's name up, but... Yeah, and so they were actually after him. But Dennis Wilson, they'd spent like a couple, weeks or days or something like that, like hanging out with him, and that's how they became interested. But even, like, that's crazy, but all of the other random people that they killed too, that's even more crazy. So.
Yeah. Did y'all read that story that was released today or yesterday about Natalie Woods, that they opened up the investigation to her death in 1981? and they opened it up against, what's his name, Wagner? I'm trying to remember it. Robert Wagner. But I didn't know that whole story that everybody else that was on that boat, it included like Christopher Walken and a boat captain, Dennis DeVern, and the cops just let it go, and they're like, she accidentally drowned, and they're like, well, that's good enough for us, and now they're opening it 40 years later.
I'm just kind of like, what kind of evidence is still there? I mean, it can't be much, honestly.
Unless, like, the captain or somebody's cooperating, it's like, yeah, you could charge me, but I'm willing to tell you what really happened, but isn't that kind of hard to prove after 30 years, as you indicate?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they'll find something, but just to me, it doesn't seem to me that there would be much left.
Yeah, it's just weird, and it kind of all connects. And wow, that's a really random tangent. How I ended up there.
Sorry.
No, that's probably my fault more than anything on that. But here's another topic, and I never thought of it this way, but with the opening a couple weeks ago, Cassie was talking about it's called like the Draft Thistle, and it's located in Spring, and one of the big things is it's a bar that has a huge selection. Think of Bash's beer selection with a couple on tap, but really everything's in cans. But the place has no TVs at all because it's not art. It doesn't have physically TVs. It has one projector because it's not an actual sports bar. Well, Deadspin.com posted an article this week that bars that aren't sports bars shouldn't have TVs because it's meant to be a conversation or something else. What are your thoughts on that? Because I, for one, don't agree, but I feel like Lubbock's influencing me for that, because I used to go out and I'd be fine going to a bar watching TV even if there's nothing on it. But what are y'all thoughts?
I mean, I would be okay going to a bar with no TVs and things like that. I just think that the bar's got to have something else, like some other hook, some other, you know, shtick, as it were, something to get people there. Because I feel like a lot of the reason, you know, that people go to sports bars is to watch sports and things. I mean, there's karaoke bars, I guess, but there's still usually a TV or two there. So, I mean, it's just got to have something else that is going to keep people interested. Food.
I don't think you need it. I think for actual sports bars, people go there to watch sports and enjoy their team, and it's a great place to meet and hang out with people. But sometimes you just want to go maybe be social, and I think when you don't have a TV, one of two things is going to happen. You're going to see a lot of people on their phones, which you already do, or people are going to strike up a conversation with their neighbor.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a possibility. I don't really go to bars much anymore. But even in my Lubbock days, sure, occasionally go to a sports bar like Fox and Hound to watch a game, but not typically. Usually went to Fox and Hound to hang out with my friends and have a good time. And for me, it was more about the social interaction than what was on TV. If I want to watch TV, I'll just go home or Mike's place.
And I think Lubbock is a good example, as you do have Fox and the Hound example, which always had sports on, even though that wasn't the main reasoning. But then you also had places like Latiosa, where there's not a TV in the place. But also, isn't that kind of gearing towards a different clientele, a different purpose, different drinks? Because like at Cafe J, I don't remember them having TVs either. But you would go somewhere else. Or what was the other place? The French restaurant that became German later on. The Vine? I didn't think that bar had one.
Chez Suzette?
Yeah, Shea Suzanne. Like, it was perfectly a good bar without it. But I don't know. Sometimes I just like being in a bar where there's a TV. The younger I was, the more influence that had on my decision. That if I could watch basketball and drink out and drink and hang out with my friends, then that will be the option instead of not watching basketball and drinking with my friends, because I know that place will be more expensive if they don't have a TV.
True.
Well, and I will say this. A lot of the places you just named aren't open anymore either. So that's, I'm not saying it's because they didn't have a TV, but if they don't have something that's going to attract people, then...
I can't believe Fox closed. What replaced it?
Oh, it's a new seafood and martini lounge opening up sometime this year.
Wow.
That's an interesting choice for Lubbock. Way to go.
Yeah, so, it's by the guy who owns Las Parises and Buffalo Wild Wings. So.
Okay, wow. So now there's two seafood bars in town. So yeah. Oyster bar in this place that's opening up.
There's an oyster bar in Lubbock now?
No, always been, hasn't there?
Oh, you mean Lone Star Oyster Bar? Oh,
yeah.
My bad.
Yeah.
My bad. I forgot.
I didn't say classy. I just said Oyster Bar.
Well, and actually, I will say this. They do have the freshest oysters in Lubbock. Like, they are very proud of the fact and that they get them delivered very, very regularly and stuff like that. So, you know, now I will say this, I'm not an oyster person, but comparing them to oysters that you'd get like in San Francisco or like a big seafood port and stuff, yeah, not very fresh. But compared to Lubbock, yeah, they're a lot fresher than what you're going to find anywhere else. So, yeah.
I'm sad. You know why I'm sad?
Why?
America.
Like, fried oysters were always fine, but it's like a fried thing, whatever. I never thought I liked oysters, and my dad is a huge oyster fan. So I had tried some with him, and I'll try anything. I didn't dislike it, but I didn't love it. I just didn't get it. Like, why would I pay this? And then I went to Seattle, and I had some cold water oysters, and I was, like, in heaven. And now I love oysters, but I just know. I don't like Gulf oysters. I don't like warm water oysters, so I'm looking for cold water. And had I known what I liked, I probably could have had some delicious oysters in Lubbock, but I didn't know what I liked when I lived there. Now I do.
I'm pretty sure it's all perspective, because somebody else on this podcast introduced me to blue cheese, and, like, I hated it, and then introduced it to me in the
right
circumstance.
She was like, port!
Yeah, but then I expanded past just drinking it with or eating it with port, and to where it's just like, oh, you've got a bacon and blue cheese burger. I will have one.
I was going to say, you became a blue cheese aficionado for a good, like, 4 years after not eating blue cheese at all. And the problem with Lubbock is every time you would order, like, blue cheese, you had to cross your finger, because sometimes it'd be, like, crumbled blue cheese, which was perfect. But then sometimes places would just pour, like, blue cheese dressing all over the burger and destroy it.
Yeah, completely agree. That burger from Fox and Hound is still in my top five favorite meals of all time in Lubbock. Like, that, and it's not just, like, because it was such a good burger, but it'd be because it, like, there'd be, what, seven of us sitting at the bar, and, like, one of us would order it and be like, oh, I'll have one, I'll have one, I'll have one. Like, then all of a sudden you'd get, like, six black and blue burgers. So... Like,
it was very
most,
good.
That was the most shared meal I think I've ever had, like, as far as shared favorites here. So, and nobody's ever had one that I think was as consistently good as Fox and Hound was. And then they took it off the menu. And then they were cursed to the hell of bankruptcy.
Well,
much like
I also
the other
think
place that I cursed.
Gabe left. Gabe left and they were done.
Yeah, they took it off the menu. They painted the walls red. And then they increased prices and took away specials. It's like they didn't want customers there. It's similar to any brand where they just want to slow down business, so they increase the price just to be like, ah, we'll be fine with less customers making more money each one. But then those customers start dying off or they go out less, and then you're screwed. And that's what happened to Fox and Hound.
places and people that I've cursed in my life. And I do feel strong attraction to my Native American roots because so far, you know, cursing Fox and Hound for taking that off their menu, yeah, they failed. Cursing Harrigan's for taking meatloaf off their menu, they ended up failing. Cursing...
Harrigan's just needed that shrimp. Not jalapeno shrimp thing, right?
No, apparently not, because they closed down last year, too. Yeah, they're
done. I know, but it wasn't the meatloaf. I'm just saying.
It was the meatloaf, trust me. But, okay. What was it, Freebirds, where Pinocchio's used to be? Curse them. And also Vince Young. My four big curses in my life, and all of them have failed. I have a power, people. Don't cross me.
So, are any of you familiar with the base god curse?
The what?
No.
Okay, so there's a rapper out of Oakland. He was part of a group called The Pack. His name is Little B. And he's notorious for being like, I don't like this basketball player, so I'm cursing them. Or they said something about me, and I'm cursing them. And one of the historic ones is he told Kevin Durant, and this was the year before Kevin Durant made it to the championship with the Thunder. And Kevin Durant said something online because he wouldn't play base god because he's like 5'6". Kevin Durant said, I tried to listen to Little B and my mind wouldn't let me do it. Can't believe this guy is relevant. So Little B followed up and said, Kevin Durant will never win a title after he said Little B is a whack rapper. The base god curses. The base god curse on Kevin Durant. And so finally, like, he leaves and of course moves to Oakland and he's like, I take away the base god curse and he wins a championship. So now everybody believes in the validity of these curses. So now his new curse is on James Harden.
He's brilliant.
Yeah, that's so it's Little B and the base god curse. But based on what Mike just told me, I think you have a little more success. So this is the Mike base curse.
Wait. Silly Harden, you can't just travel to another state and not expect the Little B curse to follow you. Little B warned Harden to stop stealing his dance moves. Oh man, this is great.
So you do know, you're online, you have to look it up. Yeah, he's so serious about this. Yeah. And so, alright, I just thought I'd bring that up. I keep getting the show off topic or wherever we're going.
I want to be off topic still. I need to ask Mike. I'm sorry, your Native American roots?
Yeah, according to Ancestry.com's DNA results, I am 1% Native American, despite the fact that my dad's grandmother was 100%. Only 1% of that DNA ended up with me. So,
are you saying you got one of those DNA tests?
Yeah, it was actually pretty fascinating. Me and my sister were completely
different.
Yeah,
I always wanted to do that.
See? I hear the Ancestry.com one is the most accurate, because I saw a couple ones on YouTube, like 23andMe, and two twins, and like three sets of twins did it, and they all got different results.
Oh.
They say
Ancestry. But were they identical or fraternal?
They were identical twins.
Here's where it's interesting. I uploaded my results separate from to my profile in Ancestry and wasn't connected to my mom on it, right? It recommended my mom as my closest relative on Ancestry just based upon the DNA results. And I thought that was really cool. Like if I didn't know who she was and everything, I'd be like, oh crap, this woman might be my mother. And of course she is, and I know that and stuff. And like I recognized her profile, but I thought that was really cool. And it recommended a bunch of other people that I have no clue who they are. Like, and they're like distant Laughlin relatives and stuff. But, Amy and I are, the funny thing is my sister, the person who I should be closest to, I'm closer DNA wise to my mom. Than Amy is, obviously, but Amy, I'm closer to some of my cousins than I am my own sister. It's really weird, but it's kind of cool. So
that is kind of cool. And
I'm jealous. You know, my dad was adopted, so I know. And like curiosity,
like for you especially and stuff, it'd be kind of cool to see what DNA you guys have, like in you, what's expressed.
It's like Cassie did the same thing for her grandfather because he was adopted, to finish like that aspect of the family tree, because she was already building the family tree through ancestry, but it stopped right there because he didn't have any information to go back to it. And so I think she was able to get more information, but she went through ancestry and not the other two brands.
So ancestry, that's what y'all are saying? Because I'm so curious, and I would never, my dad didn't get adopted as a baby. He got adopted as a 6 or 7 year old, and so he remembers bad experiences with his bio mom and with foster parents. He didn't have a super great childhood, so he has zero interest, and I would never disrespect him. Because I've had conversations in the past, and I know he said the only reason I would ever want to meet my biological mother is to spit in her face. Like, and I've never said anything to him about it again. I never would, because I never would want to upset him, because he didn't have a great start to life. However, I'm super curious, and now I've had some medical issues that are pretty huge. That they think are hereditary, but we can't really trace anything because nobody in my family has the things that we know of. Anyway, so I'm kind of fascinated. So maybe this will give me the push to follow through with it. I digress too now. My apologies.
Yeah. And so, well, I was going to do one more story, and this one is really geared towards the service industry, as we talked about all the reminiscent hangouts of Lubbock, Texas. And this is beer to be released to raise awareness of tip minimum wage in Texas. Posted on the HoustonChronicle.com by William Axford. Workers' rights and craft beer are colliding in the Lone Star State with Oasis Texas Brewing Company's 2.13 Pale Ale, named after the minimum wage in Texas for tipped employees, which has not changed since 1991. The beer company teamed up with In the Weeds, a collective located in Austin, aimed at bettering the lives of people in the service industry. According to Craft Beer Austin, the beer was also created as an appreciation to those in the service industry. A person who works for tips is a gambler, wagering their smile, personality, hospitality to pay the bills. In the Weeds founder, Casey Hensley, told Craft Beer Austin, "This beer is a salute to our industry and the people that risk making $2.13 an hour." Now, this beer cannot be found in Texas right now, as I went looking today for it at three locations. I'm in Houston. But we all agree on the show, I'm pretty sure we all agree, that the $2.13 minimum wage is too low. What should the minimum wage for tipped employees be? And will that change your tipping habits?
The minimum wage, I'm very opinionated on this. The minimum wage for tipped employees should be the actual minimum wage. You can't live on minimum wage. You can't live like everybody else. It's not the 70s. It's not the boom. Things are expensive. You have to have roommates. You have to struggle. You can work 50 hours a week, half time and a half for the extra. You can't live on minimum wage. I mean, you can, but it's not easy, and you probably can't do it as a single person. And the tips that you get aren't that much. Like, thank you. You go out and you have a dinner. And sure, at the nicer, more expensive restaurants, you're probably going to get some better tippers, and you probably grow your way into that position. But I think if you're at, like, say, your standard average everyday restaurants, your chain restaurants, your Chili's and Applebee's and Buffalo Wild Wings and whatnot, your bills aren't that big, and you're only getting, some of us in the service industry are pretty regularly tipping 20% plus, but most people aren't. They're tipping 15%, 18% if you're lucky. And 20% is usually coming from service people. That's what I think. So I think the actual minimum wage plus the tip. I think that's fair.
Right.
I'm not saying $15 an hour. That's my opinion.
I'm not saying $15 an hour in general, but it does depend on what I tip. Because one of the things with tipping is exactly right as you indicate. Depending on the restaurant that they're serving at, there's more opportunity. And I feel like if you're at a family restaurant, there's a lot less opportunity to get that money. Because one, it's not going to be a specialty drink place, and drinks are ultimately what add to the tab and create that extra tipping opportunity for employees. So just comparing the concept of why, like, Chili's is so focused on their mixed drinks is because that's how they know they're going to get their staff more money and increase their margins overall with beverage sales. That being said, I think we should just set a wage for servers and make tipping optional. Because a 20% tip, just because the company's not willing to pay, is outrageous. And if they continue not to pay, that only means the tipping's going to go up to 25 just to keep up with the cost of living, or even to maintain some semblance close to it. So I think the restaurant should be responsible for making sure they have a living wage. And if they can't, then maybe they don't need a restaurant. Because 20%, it's starting to feel outrageous that now, like, the bottom of receipts have tipping for 18, 20, and 25. So that means the expectation in 4 or 5 years is going to be you have to tip 25 on the low end, and 30 is where it should be. And I'm not willing to accept that as part of my life right now. That just doesn't, that something feels wrong about that, and not being able to depend on a check does too. And the other thing is we're missing out on tax money because they're only putting down enough tips to not have to pay more tax, or so the company doesn't have to pay them minimum wage. And that means the government's missing tax money that we need to build infrastructure and other stuff. So this is a win for nobody, and the tipping and the cost definitely needs to be increased. But if that means $2 more for my meal so the waiter could have a living wage, I'm all for that. Even though that means we go out to eat once less a month, I'm for making sure they can afford to pay their bills on a regular basis. And $2.13 is outrageous. Like, it was easy to live off of my first couple years in college, but that's because I had no responsibility. I don't see how professional servers do it.
I'm glad you brought that point up. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Mike, but I had two comments. I'll let Mike go next. I'll just say my first one was, just increase the food costs. And I'm happy with that as well. Make the food more and pay the people. I'm okay with this.
Well, I think you're both wrong. If these waiters and waitresses and bartenders stop living in sin and spending their wages on alcohol and heroin and gay sex, then they wouldn't have to worry. They could live off $2.13 if they stopped living in sin. That's clearly the thought process behind it. But we're trying to keep them moral, trying to keep them take their money, take it home, you know, instead of going out and buying crack cocaine and Tide Pods and snorting those. You know, if they'd stop doing that, they could live. But no, sorry, that was a little bit of other Mike speaking there for a second. No, it's funny to me that basically what restaurants are saying is that, like, oh, we'd have to close down. I'm like, so you're basically saying that in order to pay people living wage, you couldn't afford to work. It's like what Chris said, like, they'd have to close down, right? And I get that there's restaurants that are barely making it and things like that. And basically, I guess the other end of that argument is there's customers who are saying, no, we're not going to go out. We're just going to let all these places bankrupt. Like, it's a delicate balance, and everything. I mean, I luckily started working at Pinocchio's Pizza, and it was minimum wage was like four something. No, it was $5.15 by the time I started there. And everything plus tips and you know, the most people were like, well, you got tips. I'm like, yeah, but the most common tip, and Chris will back this up, on a large pizza, which was $9.36 with tax and everything, we'd get $10. Right, Chris? 64 cents, like the change amount up to the next dollar amount. That's our most common tip. And I'm sure in restaurants and bars, it maybe is a little bit better, but like, I kind of look at people and like, especially people who leave cash and stuff. I mean, it's like, it's a dollar, it's a two, and like, I at minimum leave five, you know, even if it's a five, if I get one beer and it's $5, then it's like, all right, well, here's another five. If I get two beers, it's like, $5, you know. Still, until it gets to the point where it's like, you know, above 20% is more than $5, you know, and I usually tip 20% on average. But, yeah, it's just, it's one of those things that doesn't, their arguments are, well, we couldn't function. Well, then my argument is, well, then you shouldn't function. I mean, if you can't afford the people, then you don't afford to be in business. And I'm hearing a little bit of this just because of the job I currently have.
It's no, one of those things. I loved it there, and it was a great start.
I actually don't think that most places pay people what they're worth. And like, I've seen all of these comments, and not to get off on a tangent here, but it's just like, oh, see, AT&T is giving people bonuses because of the tax cuts. And I'm like, well, technically those tax cuts for that business don't come until their 2018 tax returns, which they won't file until 2019. So if they're paying people now, it means they could already afford to do that. And they just decided to do it now because of the tax cuts. They're basically paying people in advance off of a future return. And one of the things that my mom pointed out that people aren't really realizing, like, I've had friends like, oh, look how much more money I got. Thanks, Obama. I'm like, okay, yeah, but look at the actual wording. Like, you might still get your single deduction, but there's your personal exemption has been taken away and stuff like that. I feel like people are going to end up owing more money than they have before and than they ever have to have had to pay and stuff. And so it's one of those things that I'm kind of like, glad I don't work right now. I'm not really having to deal with it and everything. But just looking at what my situation would have been, I would have been getting more money on my paycheck, but I would have ended up owing a lot more money in 2019 on my taxes. So I'm not really certain that the payoff was there. I think people are just kind of seeing that it's there in the short term and stuff. So I don't know. Not to get off on a tangent in tax law and stuff like that and politics, but perspective, as it were. So,
yeah.
And if I could add add one thing to the conversation about tipping and compensation, is with the food industry, if you can't concede or understand why they need more money for compensation because they're already getting tips and that should be enough. Just think, because they don't have a minimum wage and because they don't have that safety net of insurance or anything else, without that money means people serving your food, making your food, ordering your food are going to work sick because they can't afford not to. They can't fall back on the hours and say, I'll do paperwork or accounting to get that money. They have to work because their salary's only $213. And now they need more money to pay their bills and their livelihood. So because they don't have money means you have a higher risk of getting sick if you go out to eat on a regular basis. And with the flu season this bad, where they're saying this flu is already like worse than the pink flu when it was the pig flu. This is by far worse, and we're not even through flu season yet. Servers not getting compensated add to this epidemic. So I just want to keep that in mind in case there's anyone listening, all two of you, who might not agree with compensating our servers more. All right. Okay.
Exactly.
And so, well, before we go on to the next one, we do have Drunk Logic time. And
oh, yay.
And I think this one is probably better for pitchers than anything else because it's kind of hard and it's taken a while to open. I apologize about that. But this article, one, it comes from Europe and you'll see why with the title, but the pitcher, it's an understatement if you can't see the pitcher. So I'm going to put it as the actual pitcher of the episode. This comes from The Sun, a News UK company. Hilarious moment, drunk Chinese bloke gets his head stuck in a narrow prison bars as he protests his innocence. Footage from inside Harbin City Station in China shows the man panicking as his head has somehow squeezed between the metal poles. He could be heard shouting at cops while he struggles. I did not break the law. I just stopped my car and slept. I do not know why you arrested me. Come take a picture of me. I want a picture. Eventually, cops somehow managed to wrestle him free at the detention center by bending the bars open. It's not clear how he managed to get his head stuck in there in the first place. Police later confirmed he was initially detained for drunk driving offense and was put in the cell overnight to sober up. I think this is drunk logic. If you get your head stuck in between bars, you're probably too drunk to be driving.
Probably.
Like, you definitely shouldn't be on the road operating a machine. But
no. I know. Let me stick my head through the bars. Maybe I'll escape.
When you see this picture, you're going to be amazed how his head could get stuck in those bars because it doesn't look possible. Like, I'm still kind of blown away just looking at it now. But I wonder, does he have to pay for the bars since they have to bend it to open it? Or is that a liability on their end that a prisoner was able to get his head stuck in there?
Probably both.
Very true.
They're probably going to charge him. And he's probably going to get an attorney. Will probably be a state-appointed attorney. But that will probably be a thing they try to do to help his sentence.
He did get his head stuck, so he should only have to do community service for 10 hours, as now his picture is plastered over the internet. Isn't that punishment enough? Because that does kind of...
Okay, so he asked them to take a picture, and they did?
I think he was just drunk babbling. But it looks like they took a couple pictures, because the picture's kind of grainy, so it does look like it's coming from a security camera. But I don't know, maybe somebody took their smartphone and hooked up the picture and sent it to the Sun.
That's funny. So. But if it's grainy, with our phones today, our phones don't take grainy pictures. It's probably from a security camera.
Or it's a flip phone. Maybe they're not allowed to have the smartphones in the prison, and they're still using flip phones from The Sopranos.
Wow.
I don't know. Well, I guess off to the next segment is the entertainment. What have you been watching? And then one thought that I sent out earlier is, what are the top five movies since 2013 that are based on a true story? So, what have you been watching? Anything new? And then your top five list.
In terms of new things, pretty much just been catching up on some old TV shows. Although I will say I did finally watch Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Yeah, I'm not even going to review it. This week, though, I did go see a movie based upon real life, and it was called I, Tonya. And for those of you who don't know what it is, it's the semi-factual story of the Tonya Harding versus Nancy Kerrigan, you know, police baton to the knee and everything. And it's the movie is factual in that it's pretty much based upon the interviews with the participants. Not Nancy Kerrigan, obviously, but the bodyguard, Tonya Harding, her husband. It goes into Tonya Harding's mother, goes into her childhood and her upbringing and things like that. I think the movie is intentionally funny in that there's a lot of fourth wall breaking and stuff, and like they talk directly to the camera, even sometimes right in the middle of the action. You know, it can't have all happened that way, but first things first, the acting was superb. I was very impressed with Margot Robbie as Tonya Harding. There's a moment in the movie, and I'm not going to spoil it, when it's just like, I've gone and rewatched this moment now, and I never realized Tonya Harding was actually a good skater, and she was the best in the world. And you get that from the actress and things like that, and you do kind of get that this ruined her entire life. Whether or not that's her fault, I'll leave it up to the audience, but definitely you maybe don't need to see this in theaters, but you need to see this movie. It's crazy, and especially us, since we grew up with that and that happening in the 94 Olympics and stuff, it's crazy enough to watch. But kind of on to the main topic, as it were, for tonight. Tasked with kind of coming up with a top five list is always hard, but looking at a specific segment of, roughly by my count, there's between 300 and 400 movies since 2013 and 2017 that were based upon actual events. I narrowed my list down to movies that were nominated or won some kind of award, so I got it down to about 38 and everything. And I'll roughly run through my entire list, and then I'm going to kind of break it up and how I came up with my top five. 2013, my list from that year was roughly 12 Years a Slave, American Hustle, Dallas Buyers Club, Wolf of Wall Street, Captain Phillips, Fruitvale Station, Lone Survivor, Pain and Gain, and Rush. 2014, American Sniper, The Imitation Game, Selma, The Theory of Everything, Foxcatcher, Citizen Four, Love and Mercy. 2015, Spotlight, The Big Short, Bridge of Spies, Trumbo, Steve Jobs, Straight Outta Compton, Black Mass, Concussion. 2016, Hacksaw Ridge, Hidden Figures, Lion, Florence Foster Jenkins, 13 Hours, Deepwater Horizon, Snowden, Sully and Race, and then 2017 was shorter, The Disaster Artist, The Darkest Hour, Dunkirk, The Post, and I, Tonya, for instance. Okay, so kind of going into how I came up with mine for the audience, I roughly narrowed my list down to about six different categories of films. One of the big categories was economics or kind of policy and stuff, as shown by The Wolf of Wall Street and The Big Short. Another one I like to call crime, like Foxcatcher, for instance. Another segment, I'd just call this Extraordinary or Ordinary People in Extraordinary Circumstances. There's a lot of bleed over, obviously, with another segment, war, like I like to call it. But these are movies that are, for instance, Love and Mercy, which is the story of Brian Wilson, who was the lead writer for the Beach Boys, Steve Jobs, for instance. Another one was war movies. Another one I like to call Fight the Establishment, like Concussion, which was, for instance, Will Smith playing the doctor who was trying to expose the NFL's cover-up of concussions, but it also goes against governments, too. And then a big segment, and I kind of never thought about this as its own segment, but I went ahead and gave it one. I like to call it race relations, and kind of letting people know that there's just been a lot of movies for good reason that have been put out there about treatment of different individuals of different colors, different creeds, different ethnicities, different persuasions, like sexual, homosexual, things like that. So I kind of call that category race relations. I narrowed it down to five. Roughly, there haven't been very great crime movies. We haven't had a Goodfellas. We haven't had a Casino, like Chris mentioned earlier, or even another Scorsese film of those caliber. So I kind of eliminated that one. My five for Fight the Establishment was the most recent one. I called The Post and everything, just compared to some of the other Fight the Establishment movies like Deepwater Horizon or Snowden. It's a more true story. It's very important for the relation of media to government. And these times, especially, I feel like it's very important for people to watch that movie. Kind of extraordinary people in extraordinary circumstances, was Lion. Having seen that movie, it's a fascinating look at what happens when a young boy is separated from his family and then tries to track them down, and only using a few scraps from when I mean, kid was a few years old, and he has to remember, like, details and things like that. And using Google Maps and other modern resources, manages to find his family. So I thought that was a good representation of a person in extraordinary circumstances. And you know, of course, being separated from your family is one. American Sniper, I gave that to the war category because I think most movies, and if you ask me, I think the most perfect war movie out there is probably Saving Private Ryan. Great ensemble, great cast, great directing, great everything. But American Sniper is kind of the opposite of it. It's a one man who had such a huge impact, and it's told, it's a modern war. It's his four tours in Iraq and everything. And talking about Chris Kyle, the sniper with the most confirmed kills of any American soldier. And so it's just, it's a great story talking not just about his experience overseas, but his experience back home. So I felt war-wise, it's a great balance between the two. In terms of economics, I had to give it to Wolf of Wall Street. I was tempted to The Big Short just because that's the most relevant to the times, the most recent. But I kind of feel like it goes back to Wolf of Wall Street and the 80s, and Greed is Good, according to Gordon Gekko. You've got to see Wolf of Wall Street to kind of understand why banks can lose money and everything, or why anybody can really lose money in the stock market. Race relations or relations, I kind of had to give it to Selma. And my reasoning, I was really tempted to give it to Fruitvale Station or 12 Years a Slave, but Selma, I feel like, is a good explanation because the Voting Civil Rights Act had just been passed, or the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act had just passed, but there was still inequality, and it happened like a year ago, and in the time of the movie. And so this march to Selma, you know, by Dr. King and associates, I feel is so important to watch. And so those are kind of my top five important movies based upon real world events. I did omit a couple of movies. The Disaster Artist, I wanted to count for extraordinary or ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances, but I kind of feel it's almost a little too funny for everything else. But those are the ones that I picked for my top five. And I'm out.
All right. And thank you, Mike. And one of my inspirations for really setting up this segment is it did start as just of what we've been watching, but as Mike, the curator, the owner of Assume You Know Nothing, hopefully I can get a guest gig on there if we have enough topics, I enjoy discussing movies, and now we have that opportunity as he has a show, so maybe he can even sponsor this segment. But what I've seen recently, this week I did go see the movie Den of Thieves. It features Gerard Butler and some other actors that you're familiar with, but I couldn't remember their name, nor would it really matter.
50 Cent.
Yeah, 50 Cent and Liev Schreiber, who you might see him in Orange is the New Black, the second season of The Wire he was big in. He's a really good actor, kind of one of those underrated actors that will probably like hit his peak in 5 years. He'll finally get that role. But that movie, it was surprisingly a good movie. I was kind of expecting something else. But it's a good, it has shootouts, it has strategy, good dialogue, and it's about a group of bank robbers and them trying to rob the biggest bank in the nation, or the most secure bank in the nation, in the Federal Reserve. And it goes on from there. Of course, there's a twist, but it's, I didn't see it coming, so I would suggest everybody go and see it. It might not be, it's not going to win any awards at the Grammys, but it doesn't mean that, or at the Oscars, but it doesn't mean that it's not good. It's going to be purchased either by, like, I imagine HBO has already put in money for it, or Stars, since it's 50 Cent, Stars already bought it, but it's a good movie. But one of the things that I did, when I came up with my list for the top five movies based on true events, unlike Mike, I really didn't focus on events that I had familiarity with prior to the movie coming out. So it really excluded a good amount of movies that I did have in the honorable mention. So, of course, that would include, like, the 12 Years a Slave. Selma is definitely up there. Hidden Figures didn't make the top list, but was just outside of it. But once again, it's because it was based on something that I already had familiarity with. And so there wasn't anything a surprise. The movies that really stood out to me were ones that, stories that probably were widely known to the public. I just didn't have a real insight to it, and they attributed to my appreciation of something else, which would be the lead couple of movies. And then other ones would be related more so to, just that it was well put together and good acting. So my list, and what I call the list of truth, is the number one is Wolf of Wall Street. I didn't expect it. I've always been a fan of The Boiler Room, and this is The Boiler Room on steroids. It's such a long movie, but it's entertaining the whole way through, and the fact that it's based on a true story, and you go and compare the true story to this one, there's not that many big differences, and that's what really stands out to me and puts it up there, and it's well-directed, well-acted, and I have my own list that hopefully, when Mike has an episode and opening, we can go over it, the uncommon scale. And this one scores really high for me because it does fit into the sixth category, the top category of, being, nominated in one of the best films I've ever seen. So I definitely want to put it there. The second one is Rush, and it's about, Formula One racing, are what they call open wheel racing, and it looks similar to go-karts or the ones that you see at the Track of the Americas that's really big out in Austin. And it's just a good movie because, one, it's based on a true story. It really does connect with the true one once you watch the documentary. It's based in the mid-70s about James Hunt versus Niki Lauda and their intense rivalry and just the characters, the story, the respect, and how it's all created. And the fact that it's real and some of the people are still alive in the movie gives it a little more credence. The third one is The Big Short. Just well executed, and it's like the first movie where I didn't see, where I actually felt they played different characters than what they usually, and the main one is Michael from The Office, who I feel like always plays some sort of the same role. But this one was phenomenal, and even the ways how they explained it and broke it down to somebody who's unfamiliar with the market, it felt like an educational piece as well as a warning to the general market. The other one that's up there is I do have Pain and Gain, which is a story I didn't realize, and it was just so insane that I definitely enjoyed it. And the other one is The Founder. Another one that's about a huge brand. It's about McDonald's and how Ray Kroc, while he's the engine and the recognizable figure of growing McDonald's to its current behemoth that it is now, it's about the whole background and how he screwed the originators of McDonald's out of their own business due to his conniving salesman-y nature. It's well done. And another one to add to the cap of Michael Keaton and the resurgence of the third half of his career, that I feel like, maybe this is blasphemous, Michael Keaton's become so good that I feel like Michael Douglas should give Michael Keaton back his name so he can go by his birth name, and Michael Douglas has to choose a new one. Because Michael Keaton has clearly surpassed him in the acting, the skill, and just the roles that he's willing to take. That he's not boxing himself in the corner. He's gone from playing a superhero character in Birdman to playing an actual villain in Spider-Man to playing Ray Kroc. Who would have saw that coming when Batman came out when we were in elementary school? So just a bit mind-blowing. Two of my
honorable... Can I add to that?
Yes, absolutely.
And I'm glad you have honorable mentions, because I do too. I loved The Founder, and Chris recommended it to me. And while Chris was saying, he screwed him out of this, but I caught another part of that, and I told Chris when I was done, I'm like, thank you for recommending it. Like, I'm in a love-hate relationship with this guy, but while you could look at it from one angle, he screwed him out of their family business. You could look at it from another angle, McDonald's wouldn't be what it is today if it weren't for him. And so I feel like you have to take the positive out of that. Like, you've got stores all over the world. That means you employ thousands of people. You have a Ronald McDonald Foundation for, so there's a lot of good that came out of it. I mean, it's still capitalistic. Let's not kid ourselves. But at the rate of the other guys, McDonald's would not be the company it is without Ray Kroc. And I really enjoyed that. And like I said, I'm just like, I left that in a love-hate relationship because there's good, but there's bad. Both. Okay, I'm done.
No, absolutely. They definitely wouldn't be who they are. They probably wouldn't have expanded from their couple locations at their original location if it wasn't for Ray Kroc. But pretty much, I think the movie tries to convey that Ray Kroc, as a human being, probably wasn't a great person, but as a businessman, genius. Absolutely. My honorable mentions is definitely Hidden Figures, one of the best movies, a story I wasn't familiar with. The reason it didn't make the top five list is the replay value is low for me, that once I watch it, I doubt it's something that I'm going to watch again, probably until Christopher's a little older and I want him to just have some historical context and background of interesting people. But it's not something that I'm just going to put on a Saturday and be like I'm watching Hidden Figures. And maybe that's attributed to I don't have a daughter, and there's plenty of examples of successful black men out there for my son to look up to. And as a female, a young woman, there's not as many examples of women succeeding in the science and math put in the form of entertainment. And so there's a real strength there, but that's why it was moved down on my list. I have two other ones that I recommend. Mastermind, which can be found on Netflix now. It's about the largest bank car heist ever. It stars Zach Galifianakis and Jennifer Aniston. It's a true story. It's insane and it's entertaining. Mastermind. So look that up if you haven't already. And the reason why Selma, The Butler, Moonlight's not on my list, because I haven't seen them. And I'll just go out and say that. Selma, I kind of knew the story already. 12 Years a Slave. The story's depressing. I'm not going to watch that. The same as we've had a discussion years ago about Schindler's List, Christy and I, and I hold to that statement, but we're not going to talk about it on air. But my other recommendation is Kill the Messenger, which is about the Iranian-Contra affair and the reporter who uncovered it, identifying that the government was shipping in cocaine to the U.S. to sell so that they could pay for the war and the training in Nicaragua to overturn the government. There's been many other shows that kind of connect to this. There's a current documentary about the real Rick Ross, who was the person who was in charge of distributing that in the U.S. There's a show on FX, Snowfall, which is one of the best shows on air right now. But the weird part about Kill the Messenger, I kind of had a semblance of this because I knew the story before, because the reporter who identified it and came out with the report committed suicide with two gunshots to his head. So just putting that out there, it's still a good movie. The guy who plays Nighthawk or Hawkeye from the Avengers plays the main character in that.
Jeremy Renner.
So that's my list. It's not as detailed as Mike, but certainly an overview of what I think, if you haven't had an opportunity to watch these movies, would certainly be worth your time if you have a couple bad weather days where you're stuck in the house.
Awesome. Great list. So I guess it's my turn. I love how we've rated things all very differently, and I haven't watched all the movies, so I'll preface with that as well. But I know who I am, and you guys know who I am, but I'm a bit of a civil rights softie, and I try to understand and talk to people, and I live in a very conservative state. I lived in Lubbock, which is extremely conservative. Now I live in Georgetown, which is also very conservative. And so, because my list is what it is, I'm just going to say politics does come into play. And I've talked to you guys in depth over the last couple of years with the Black Lives Matter movement and things that are going on, and Blue Lives and all of the things, and white privilege, all of these things. So my top five are not in any particular order, but 12 Years a Slave, and I get it. It's depressing, and it's horrible, and it was really hard to watch. It was very difficult to watch. But I think it was important because in my life, I try to talk about the other opinions, and what I hear a lot is, and I'm turning the PC off right now. What I hear a lot is, we didn't do this to them. These people weren't slaves. But their families were, and they grew up like this, and they're still being oppressed. They just are. So I think to see that, it makes it a little bit more real, like, this happened and it wasn't that long ago. Selma's on my list. Of course, the Voting Rights Act was on Mike's list. Also, one of my favorite ones, also being a woman, was Woman in Gold. She was a Holocaust survivor.
Oh, in the painting, yeah.
Yeah. And so it was a really fascinating story. The Nazis came in and invaded and kicked them out and stole all their stuff, and then they have this really beautiful painting that belonged to her family in this museum, and she sued them, and she eventually won. I think that was a big win, and that was a very tragic time in history, and so I think that was a really beautiful, important thing to see. And then I have Loving, which was an interracial couple. Like, can you imagine our life without interracial marriage right now? Anyone? Because we're a melting pot. Like, that's kind of who we are. But can you imagine falling in love with somebody from a different race and not being able to marry them and live with them in peace and just being able to have the same life and dreams as other people? So I really love that movie. And then another one, I used to run track and cross country, so I had to go see it. Was Race. Really loved this. And it was really the first black man. He was super fast, and he was the first Olympian, and it showed all his struggles. And then having won, and having people from other countries, some of them were worse, but some of them were a lot more accepting. But then to be a huge winner in the Olympics and then come home, and there's a big party to celebrate this, and you have to go in the service store. Like, I mean, I think it's important to see these things and see where we've came. So pretty much all of mine are civil rights in some way or another. My honorable mentions are Wolf of Wall Street, which I really loved. Steve Jobs, because, okay, we all know who Steve Jobs is, and he's in our lives right now, but he changed our world. Like, he changed the way we live our daily lives. So I think that's an honorable mention. And then I have American Sniper, Chris Kyle. I'm a Texan, and when I moved to Georgetown, it was not soon after that they were taking his body, and actually I didn't know what was happening. And there were all these flags and fire trucks on the bridges and American flags hung down. I didn't know at the time what was going on because I was caught up in the move, but it was his body being transported. And so as a Texan, I think that was really important. So that's my list. Hello?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
I had it on mute myself, so I apologize about that.
No, it's okay. I was just like, wait, are we still there?
And so, absolutely.
I wasn't muting you, Christy.
Reiterating your point earlier, I'm really surprised at how we came to our conclusions and the difference of our list. So that was pretty enjoyable, and hopefully we can come up with some other ones, because I had a good time of just thinking about it and putting it in order of how my movies fell there, or fell within the list.
Yeah, I couldn't come up with an order for mine necessarily, other than, I mean, I think it just is going to depend upon each person who looks at my list, like, what matters to them. Are they more concerned about economics and like, why aren't I making money? Are they wondering why is the government oppressing them and things like that? Or why is the media all liars? I mean, are they wondering, you know, why am I upset about having to constantly send soldiers overseas and stuff? I mean, are they wondering why I'm with Christy? I mean, I think that race relations or relations between people with differences is one of the main conflicts, but I will always say this in a kind of hopeful manner, in that as Americans, yeah, it kind of sucks now, but we're really on the forefront of the world dealing with this. Like, we're maybe not the most diverse country and everything, but we're one of the most developed, most diverse countries in terms of our different populations and stuff. So, I mean, I hate to say we're setting the template, because I feel like some places might could do it better, and especially not starting off relations with so many different groups, I hate to say it this way, but like, you know, having black people as slaves, having Chinese people build all of our railroads, having Mexicans fix all of our cars and do all of the cleaning and stuff. I mean, it's kind of the stereotypes, as it were, and stuff. But that's kind of how we started them all. So it's all those stereotypes are our fault. But I do feel like, I'm hopeful that, you know, this we're getting better. I mean, it's like Christy said, 60 years ago, some of the ways that, you know, some of the things that have happened couldn't have happened 60 years ago. So I'm hopeful that despite how troublesome it is, all these movies coming out, maybe it does bring a little bit of light to some of these areas that maybe people didn't know or weren't paying attention to. It's like Chris said, a lot of these movies, before I watched the movie, I didn't know that this stuff happened. So, you know, it's good. That's what film is there for. It's to entertain and instruct. So.
All right. Well, I think that's all I had listed on the docket tonight. We have been going for a while. So was there anything you'd like to add, Christy or Mike?
Yes, I have something.
Okay.
I'd like to give a huge shout out to my mom, Michelle, who is living her best life tonight at the Barry Manilow concert in Houston. She's been following him since 1976. So for those of you who can't count, that is 42 years.
41.
42?
Oh, my bad.
It'll be 42 sometime this year.
Yeah, I was born in 76, so I don't think it happens until October.
Anyway, so props to you, Mom, for living your best life and following your dreams, and even after retirement, going to those shows, because that's how we keep those artists paid, is those live concerts. So that's all I've got today.
I might have two things.
Okay.
I have one thing for sure. Tomorrow, I am leaving work early, I think. No, I'm kidding. I am. I got extra workers. I am going to go see Trevor Noah. I'm super excited.
That is
Trevor Noah Live.
That's awesome. And so
where's my other thing is, oh, he's going to be at Bass Concert Hall.
Okay.
It was an anniversary gift from my boyfriend, but he had a conference. I tried to surprise him. It's hard to surprise busy people. I asked him before I got the tickets. I was like, hey, do you have anything on this date? He said no. I'm like, oh, can you block it off? Because I have something for you, but can only be used on this day. But I didn't tell him any of the details. And so then I bought the ticket. But he had a conference in Vegas, so I'm taking a girlfriend instead. Nonetheless, I'm very excited. And it's at Best Concert Hall in Austin. The only other thing I have is about my personal life. Wait, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Here's what's going on in my personal life. Yesterday, I had my second physical therapy appointment, and it was torturous. Now, you guys might recall years and years ago, and a time I barely remember, I broke my left elbow. And I went to physical therapy, and I was like, oh, it's awful, it's so painful, yada, yada. But that was not my experience. It was all very gentle and relatively easy. It took some time, but I got full motion back in my elbow. This is not what is happening right now. You've got all these nerves in your hands and fingers, and it's very painful, and it's awful. And even though I didn't cry, there were lots of inappropriate words in my head. That is all.
Okay.
Well, I'm happy.
Don't break my hand. Good to know.
Happy to hear you're on your way to recovery, and hopefully you'll reflect back on this experience similar to the elbow recovery, which seemed so painful. I just remember seeing the pictures at that time.
I think the funniest thing that happened today is, and this happens, you guys all know from having worked in the industry, people say, oh, I should come visit you. I should come see the winery. I should come try some wines. Well, so my physical therapist said this when I first met her. And then we talked a little bit yesterday, and she was like, I'm going to come by. And I said, okay. I didn't actually expect her to. So my CrossFit coach is also a member. And she was in today, and I was showing her my new torture devices. Oh, I mean toys that my physical therapist gave me. And I was doing the exercises because we weren't busy at the moment. It was earlier in the day. And guess who walks in? My physical therapist. You cannot buy a moment like that. My physical therapist walked in, and I was using the torture devices, a.k.a. toys, that she gave me. It's priceless.
That's
what's going on in my life. That's what I'm doing with my life.
Well, still planning for next weekend. I go out to travel for a friend's wedding. The Bodnars are getting married. Well, her last name isn't Bodnar now, but it will be. Are getting married, and so that's going to be a big celebration, and can't wait to see everybody there. A couple of things that I've been listening to. I know I'm late on this bus, the Gary Clark Jr. bus, especially I know Chrissy being just outside of Austin. They've had he's played all over that city. So I was listening to that Gary Clark Jr. live album from 2014, which is phenomenal. And I'm also late on the Anderson .Paak Malibu album, which is pretty good. The other one, I found out Taylor Bennett is Chance the Rapper's little brother. Probably just as good. Might end up being better down the road. And that album's been pretty good, the mixtape that he put out this year, Restoration of an American Idol. But outside of that, nothing else, and I hope everybody has a fantastic Super Bowl. And before you leave, who do you think's going to win, and will it be a blowout or a close game? I actually have the Patriots winning. I think it's going to be a close game, and Brady will play for two more years.
This is very difficult because as a Peyton Manning fan, and also I definitely fell off the football bandwagon this year. Also as a Cowboys fan, so I really dislike the Eagles. And as a Cowboys fan, I would rather the Patriots win. But as a Peyton Manning fan, I'm tired of Tom Brady having rings and the deflate gate. Like, you already have a model. Could you just retire and be done? But on the other hand, it's like, well, it'd be kind of cool if you just won and retired. I'm so torn. I'm going to pick the Patriots close.
As I noted on Facebook today, Tom Brady is 5-0 against animal mascots and 0-2 against human mascots. So I'm picking the Patriots. And I will say, despite the fact that I don't necessarily want him to win, and I just kind of want a good game, there are two former Red Raiders, Danny Amendola, undrafted, and LaAdrian Waddle, also undrafted, on the Patriots. And so continuing the theme of undrafted players succeeding in New England, I kind of am leaning towards the Patriots. Also, if Tom Brady wins his sixth Super Bowl, despite the fact that the Eagles winning one would be a brand new team winning, and I think that's cool, it will mean that he's got more rings than the Cowboys have. So, either way, Cowboys fans Monday morning are going to be ridiculous on talk radio, and I plan to listen and enjoy every minute of their delicious tears.
Cowboy tears. Well, I'd like to thank everybody for joining FDNW today. We'll have this episode up shortly, and that part doesn't matter if you're listening to this part because it's not live and this is a bit redundant, but thank you. Like us on Facebook, like us on iTunes, give us a thumbs up. Also, send in any questions that you may have, no matter how really crazy the questions are. Kind of the more interesting is what we're looking for. And we'll be back next week with another fantastic episode.
Cheers and slancha.
Proof.
There is an agave shortage, and it has tequila makers working very hard. Margaritas, heaven forbid. And it's smaller companies right here in Houston that are feeling the pinch. Janelle Bluta is live at Specs with a closer look at this story. Hello, Janelle.
Hey, Lynn. Well, this is Houston-based tequila, Pura Vida. Now, it is made in Mexico, but it's distributed here in Houston. They sold about 11,000 cases last year. This year, they're on track to sell 16,000 cases. Just hoping that uncertainty in Mexico doesn't slow them down.
That's per kilo.
Standing in front of a whiteboard, marker in hand.
You're at about $8 just for the liquid.
Stewart's Gloss is crunching numbers.
That's just for the juice.
Figuring price points for Pura Vida tequila, his baby in a blue bottle made here at a distillery down in Mexico.
And tequila can only be made in Mexico. It's only made in 5 states, just like champagne can only be made in France.
But a key component to his super premium product, the blue agave plant from the highlands of Jalisco, is straining his bottom line.
Right now we're paying plus or minus $2 per kilo.
$2 a kilo for his blue agave seems cheap, right? But compare that to the merely 10 cents they were paying back in 2010 when they started.
At 21 pesos, we have gone up basically 2,000% since then.
An unforeseen shortage in Mexico is driving up his cost.
To get to the same profit margins where we were in 2010, today, we would have to increase our price by at least 50%.
But that's something he just won't do.
We want it to be something that everybody could afford.
What he says is happening is the big guys, his competition, are stocking up, buying years' worth of supply of agave.
They have got enough supply to last them a lifetime and then some. Well, what's happened is that it basically inflated the price of all the agave because they were buying it up everywhere for smaller guys like us to go in.
With so much out of control, Skloss says they've recently purchased their own agave growing operation, but that will be ready for another 3 years, which means until then, they're stuck with the uncertainty. Skloss says they will do everything in their power not to raise their prices, but says at some point that may be something that they will have to do. Another positive in this, though, is that several farmers in Mexico are adding agave crops, but it won't be 6 years until those are ready, Lynn.
6 years? Oh, my. All right, Janelle, thank you.